The internet has changed our lives in ways I think few of us could ever have imagined. And with the amazing advances we've seen in just the last few decades, it's fascinating, really, to think what might lie ahead. Lawrence Landweber is an emeritus professor of computer science at UW-Madison. He's a pioneer in computer networking, was recently inducted into the Innovators Circle of the Internet Hall of Fame, and he's in there with some pretty cool company. Vint Cerf, who was the father of the Internet. Some people call him the father of the Internet. Tim Berners-Lee invented the web, I believe, the World Wide Web. Ray Tomlinson, he chose the at symbol, if I'm not mistaken, and gave us email. And tell you what, Lawrence Landweber had a big part in this, too. Lawrence, Larry, hi.
Hi. Nice to see you.
Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
It's what an exciting story.
Oh, it's been an amazing ride for 30 years. It all started in the late 70s. I was working on theoretical computer science and looked around and saw all this stuff starting to happen in networking. There was some initial research, and it just seemed like the area to get into. And so I basically deep-sixed my previous research program and just switched my life around, learned about networking, and started to do projects. And I should say, in those days, nobody really believed it. I would go to cocktail parties and tell people I was working on email or electronic networks, and they'd roll their eyes and go get another drink. And that was all the way through the 1980s, pretty much.
Yeah, and so you got started in the 70s.
In the
70s. So at what point in the development, we were pretty basic back then.
Well, I would say the first 20 years, 1973 to 93, was the research phase and bringing the network to academia. Then suddenly in 93, the killer app came along, and that was the World Wide Web. And suddenly we had this resource that was applicable to real people. And, of course, we know what happened. Everything took off, information, all the information of the world online, banking, transportation, yeah, medicine, et cetera. So, yeah, I'd say 93 is when it hit the public consciousness in a real way.
In a big way. Yeah. Where did the idea for the Internet come from?
Well, there are discussions about that. There's one that says that the Defense Department in those days was interested in how do you survive a nuclear war. And so the underlying technology of the Internet allows for distribution of control among different pieces of the network, so you could lose part of it and continue to operate. I think the real thing that happened is there were people, engineers in working with DARPA and various defense contractors, who just realized that packet switching, the underlying technology of the Internet, was kind of cool, and they started working on it. I suspect the nuclear war part was an add-on after the fact.
Well, I want to give our listeners a chance to join in. As you listen to our guest today, Larry Landweber, I hope you'll join in with your own questions about the Internet. At what point in your life did the Internet come on the scene for you? How has it affected you? Do you think the presence of the Internet is it all positive? Is it more negative than positive? Some mix? I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. And go to my Facebook page. You can also post there at The Larry Mueller Show. Tell us about some of the people who were, I mentioned some names there, but were key to the development of the Internet and the World Wide Web. Who got us to the point we are today?
Well, first of all, there are many fathers, many grandfathers. I even have a button that says I'm an uncle of the Internet. And so, father-in-law, perhaps. So there literally, initially, there were a few dozen. In the 80s, there were maybe a couple of hundred people who were very involved, especially when it spread to universities. I mean, the person who gets a bum rap is Al Gore. He actually was the person in Washington who got funding for the research that led to the internet. Information superhighway, I believe, was a term that he was responsible for because he was modeling on his father's involvement with the interstate highway system.
So he did really have a role to play.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the community rewarded him by inducting him into the Hall of Fame this year. And these are not people who are who would just do it out of sympathy for him. But there were a number of exciting people. I mean, Vint Cerf and Bob Kahn, who did TCPIP, are absolutely amazing. They're still involved. Vint is now chief evangelist for Google and just a very exciting person. Bob Kahn also, he was a person at DARPA and who actually shepherded the network. And there were many others. Interesting anecdote of the early days, nobody expected spam to be as it is today. So, in fact, in those days, there was one person who was the lord and master of the internet. And so a company sent out an advertisement, and this person immediately sent them a note, said, if that happened again, you're off the internet. A country in Europe, there was some inappropriate content that came from that country. He pulled the connection, the international connection, so that Nordic country was no longer on the internet. Not the way it is today.
Oh, man. No, I guess not. Tracy in Wausau, glad you called. What's on your mind?
I want to know, what is the internet? What is the World Wide Web? What's the difference between the two? How do you pull these plugs that you just mentioned? What is this system of equipment? How is it connected? What is the internet and World Wide Web?
Okay. Right. Simple question. Right. And thank you. Very good question. Okay. For me, the internet is the worldwide interconnected collection of networks, all of which use and share the internet IP address space. So one of the key points of the internet was connectivity between all hosts or all computers connected to the internet, no matter where they are. They all today share a 32-bit. They have a 32-bit address. Going forward, with IP version 6, they'll have a 128-bit address. So that's the internet. What is the World Wide Web? The World Wide Web is an application that runs on top of the internet that has protocols like HTTP and HTML that specify formats. Now, what about pulling the plug? Well, we saw an example of pulling the plug about a year ago. If you remember Egypt, there was an order that came down from the government of Egypt, and the people in charge of the internet there pulled the plug and actually took Egypt off the internet. So it is still possible to do that, but very unlikely in places like the United States with the diverse collection of ISPs and other telcos, wireless, etc. If you have a country that has one connection point, it is possible.
Hmm. Thank you. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, that kind of helps, but I don't understand the concept of being able to pull a plug in America. I guess that's kind of too hard. All these communication devices are hooked up together so many different ways.
You can't just
disconnect all the telephones in the world. How are all these connections physically connected?
You cannot disconnect the United States. But in Egypt, there were one or two international links going out from Egypt, and therefore it was easy to turn those off.
But we have thousands.
We have hundreds. Nobody really has a good handle on how many national, international connections. There's fiber everywhere. There's connectivity everywhere. And so pulling the plug in the United States, absolutely impossible.
Thank you very much for calling, Tracy. Appreciate your call. And you can join in, too, with your own questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Boy, those are words I didn't use when I started my radio life.
Right. Yes. Yes. In fact, .org is the registry for .org is the Internet Society, which I helped found about 20 years ago, and which is the organization that does the Internet Hall of Fame. And as an interesting sidelight, the domain system is name system is big business. That organization gets something like 75 cents to a dollar for every .org registration every year, an income of about $30 million a year, and maybe $20 million, but it's somewhere in it's in the tens of millions. And all around the world, the domain name system is big business because there's a country domain in every country of the world, and there are companies that manage it.
Wow.
So the internet has been a job creator in many ways.
Tell us about your early work on network. The story that I had was that originally the network, this was kind of, the thought was that researchers could, from different universities or different places, would be able to talk with each other.
Well, the original was actually share resources.
Yeah.
Be able to access computers were expensive, be able to log in and use other computers. When I got involved, the research was still going on, and the internet was really the domain of people who had contracts with the Defense Department. There was very little of that at Wisconsin, so Wisconsin was not, up until my involvement, a very active participant. So my role was getting together a group of people from universities and proposing the building of a network that would connect all the computer research groups, whether they had Defense Department funding or not, in the United States. And it was going to be huge. It was going to be 200 sites. And in fact, the reviews that were written that came back, this is laughable today, I know, but the reviews that came back said the internet will never scale to 200 sites. The technology is just not applicable. And as a result of that, it took us almost a year to get funding for the project. That was called the CSNet project.
Larry Landweber, our guest today, Emeritus Professor of Computer Science at UW-Madison, a pioneer in computer networking and recently inducted into the Innovators Circle of the Internet Hall of Fame. He'll be with us right up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Having fun today talking with Lawrence Landweber, Larry Landweber, visiting with us about the past, the present, and the future of the Internet. He's an emeritus professor of computer science at UW-Madison, recently inducted into the Innovators Circle of the Internet Hall of Fame. And great to have him along. Certainly appreciate you listening in, and I'd appreciate any questions that you might have for him at 1-800-642-1234. And Larry, I think it's fair to say that without your work, we don't have an internet.
Well, immodestly, I could agree, but let me put that in context. In the 1980s, there was a lot of competition among different networking technologies. Governments all over around the world, including big parts of the U.S. government, opposed the adoption of the internet technology. So the project that I worked on with collaborators at Wisconsin, Marv Solomon and others, provided proof of concept that the network could scale, that people would use it, that there were applications. It gave the NSF the confidence in 1986 to then fund something called the NSFNet, which morphed into the backbone for the global internet, the first backbone prior to commercialization. So in some sense, it is the case that perhaps without the CSNet project, things might have been different in the 80s.
Yeah.
So as I say, this is a bit immodest, but okay. Larry has asked me to be immodest.
I was, and you deserve all the recognition. I'm so glad that you're inducted into the Internet Hall of Fame for your work, because it's unbelievable work. Phil in Hebron, Illinois, has a question for you. Let's go there. Phil, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, gentlemen. My question for him is, if he looks back 30 years, what's one thing on the Internet, one thing in dealing with the Internet or that he sees in the system now that 30 years ago he could have never dreamed would happen? What's the one thing that even surprises him about this whole venture?
Well, certainly the scale. I mean, in the 80s and even the 90s, I never could have imagined that there would be 2 billion people, including half a billion in China, using the internet today. So that's one. Second one is nobody really predicted what would happen with spam, the fact that it has become so predominant. And along those lines, how the degree to which that could impact how business is conducted and et cetera. So in the 80s, we were just struggling to build the academic network. In the 90s, we started to see the World Wide Web and its implications. I was giving talks in the mid-80s about how banking would be affected in transportation and education, but nobody really believed me. So the absolute scale of it, the presence in all of our lives, and the fact that it's still changing. I think the internet is going to continue to mature. 20 years from now, we'll have an internet. My prediction is it won't be anything like what we have today underneath, but people will probably still call it the internet. Remember, the internet is 40 years old.
Yeah, that's amazing. Thank you for calling. This whole business of cyber attacks is a really worrisome one, I think. And you want to comment on that?
Well, I'm told that the National Security Agency and other three-letter agencies are in the process of hiring thousands of hackers. When I say hackers, I mean people who are very good at getting into the innards of systems to work on this subject. There have been continuing battles, cyber battles, in effect, between the United States, China, France, and other countries over the last 10 years. I mean, it is not the case that any one country has been reserved in their approach to trying to infiltrate other people's systems. What we have now, though, the Stuxnet, which people found out about a little while ago, which was used in Iran to help destroy their centrifuges, that was really the first documented, publicly known case of attempting to really attack and destroy an opponent. Well, now the discussion is, what happens if we get into a cyber warfare situation? We, the United States, are much more vulnerable, perhaps, than other countries. I mean, we have our financial system, we have our transportation systems, our health systems, et cetera. And how do we protect about that against those? But more important, if we're attacked, how do we retaliate? What does retaliation mean? Is there an analog to mutually assured destruction? The world was kept safe for 30 years because everybody had hydrogen bombs. So people knew if they dropped one,
they were going to get one right back.
They would get one right back. But now what happens if we get an attack on our financial system and it takes down all the banks and all the financial, the whole financial system? Who do we go back after? How do we attack? What stops some rogue group in Kazakhstan from launching an attack against us? You know, this is a really difficult question, and one that I can assure you that people in this business in Washington and other places are really worrying about today.
Bill in Tomahawk, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi. Well, I'll see if I can form my question around your last comments, because the subject that was on my mind mostly was transparency and censorship on the existing internet. And when I think about my use of the internet, probably I use email, but I also use Wikipedia almost daily. And then, of course, there's WikiLeaks, and Mr. Assange. And as the world has become, and corporations have become, and governments have become more and more secret, the internet has become more and more transparent. And, you know, maybe you just have some comments on where we're going with that. And but really, you know, my hope is that the internet will save us. And I'll hang up and listen.
I didn't hear what your last comment was. Oh, we lost him, unfortunately.
Okay, so first of all, you're asking partly about privacy. And the axiom is there is no privacy. Okay? Everything you do on the internet, in fact, almost everything you do that gets stored electronically is going to be known to people who want to know it. Sometimes for good, sometimes for malevolent reasons. There was an article in the New York Times the other day about a company called Axion. I think it was ACX or AXCION, which has files on 500 million people around the world, medical information, health information, financial information, purchasing. So everything is out there, okay? LinkedIn just had 6.5 million passwords stolen. So we do have this problem, and maybe that's good. Maybe everything is out there and it's transparent. On the other hand, how do we protect ourselves from this? I mean, I try to be very careful. I'm sort of an anomaly. I don't use online banking, but that's just me. I don't know anybody else in that category. But the reality is, security is broken. One of the problems with the internet technology, which is why maybe we have to think about how to replace it, is that security has been broken, was broken from day one, and is broken today. No matter how hard people work, they cannot protect their systems because the software in the computers they're using do not protect them. I went to one conference where a general said, yes, we have absolute security. We line our computers with explosives, and if anybody tries to get in, the whole thing explodes. He was joking, but that's the reality. So I don't know if I've answered your question. Did I?
We actually lost that caller.
Oh, okay.
I think you did.
Yeah.
Appreciate it very much, Bill. Mike and Monona, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Larry and Larry. Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Two questions, one on the future and one on the past. The future question is, I'm wondering if Larry could talk a little bit about things that he sees from his perspective that none of us in the general community would, in terms of some big breakthrough into the future, some big wow. And then the question about the past is, can talk a little bit about the role of pornography. I understand that it's been very influential in pushing the boundaries of the internet as a key industry in that sense. So that's actually a serious question.
Yeah.
Okay. So the first one, the big wow. I think big data will have some big wows. Big data refers to collections of petabytes of data that are being collected in different application areas. What's a petabyte? Giga is a billion, tera is 1,000 times that, and peta is 1,000,000 times that. So a million billions. So that's the size of the databases that are being collected. Genomics is an example where once they have everybody's genome in a huge database, there are going to be incredible advances in medicine. And the network will make it possible to move that data around, and analytical data mining and analytics will make it possible to analyze it. So they will discover amazing things about what particular gene mutations are involved with which diseases. On the negative side, you also have companies like Axion, who collect up data on 500 million people, or NSA, which has a bigger database than anybody in the world. And they, of course, can use it in different ways. There's a very large database in the UK, which is the closest embodiment we have to George Orwell's 1984, with their 1.8 million to 4 million cameras, and collecting all of that into a database. But I think the big data stuff will be important. I think we're going to have wearable computers soon.
How is that going to... So put on your shirt and it's a computer?
Your shirt will be a computer. It'll have sensors. Anything goes wrong, you get a heart arrhythmia. There'll be a wireless message sent to somewhere. You will be able to talk to... I hate to say this. You'll be able to talk to your clothing and give it commands. Maybe you'll be in cold weather and you'll want your clothing to be to provide more insulation, or... I don't know. I mean, this is there. One of the really interesting things is what is the FAA going to do about this? You know, when we have our wearable, and I think that's going to change things. But social networking is another. Nobody has a clue what social networking is going to do to the society. We have this whole generation of teenagers who know nothing else. In 10, 15, 20 years, they're going to be running things. How is the society going to change? How are personal interactions going to change? I mean, if I were a sociologist, this is one of the things I'd be studying, because I know it's the society of 20 years from now is going to be very different from today. Okay, on pornography. Well, you know, pornography has been around, and I read the other day that somebody has applied for a .sex domain, a high-level domain for the Internet, and they're going to get it, probably, and it's just there, and I'm, you know, that's the way it is.
That's just the way it is, and it's always going to be there, probably.
It's always going to be there, and, you know, and thank you, Michael.
Jim in Minneapolis, your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you. I'm actually en route going to Wisconsin right now. The question I had was, I want to go back to security a bit, and what kind of methodologies you see changing, number one, and number two, big cloud cloud computing, is that really going to be the end game for security, the assistance of it, and three, of course, you know, the next step to being IPv6. I will preference that we make an intelligent network security appliance, so we inspect things in real time. So I'm just curious on your perspective.
Okay, well, first of all, most security problems have to do with the software in the hosts. So in some sense, Microsoft is a great supporter for jobs in the security area. There are network break-ins, and people do have detection systems. Sounds like your company is involved in some kind of a anomaly detection system. I think we have a problem as long as we are involved. We're using IP because we don't really know where things came from. We don't. We have to analyze in real time, and we do the best we can. But there are constant variations, and most attacks are not on the network itself, but on the end hosts. One of the real fears is that somebody is going to go after the large routers. I mean, there have been attacks, but mostly the denial of service. Now, as far as cloud doesn't solve any problems. Clouds are as insecure as any computing systems in the world. And there are incredible problems with clouds. When you put your stuff in the cloud, who owns that intellectual property? What happens if the company who runs the cloud goes out of business? What if the company that runs the cloud puts data on in servers in different countries? Whose laws apply? I mean, there are many legal and technical problems involved with cloud. In fact, one of the projects I'm working on is going to build a infrastructure to look at a distributed cloud structure at universities. Look up GENI, G-E-N-I, all caps, if you want to find out about that. So I think cloud is very interesting. It's a revival of the old idea of service bureau centers, but it combines networking with computing and the virtualization that's possible with computing these days. And by the way, the answer to Bassam's question from before is that I've seen a number of 5 to 10% of all electrical power in the United States being used by large data centers, the ones with tens or hundreds of thousands of computers.
Computers.
Did I answer your question?
Yes, you did. Thank you very much.
There's one other point I want to add. If somebody is listening who's thinking about a career, there will not be any unemployment among people who are interested in computer and networking security for the next 10 years. That's a prediction.
And pretty accurate one probably at that. So computer science.
Go into computer science. The message I saw a couple of weeks ago was that undergraduates were getting salaries in the range of $80,000.
Oh, man.
So.
And, well, let's just follow that for a minute. What kinds of skills do you need to be great in math, I assume?
You need to be very analytic. You have to be good in math. And you also have to be willing to spend a lot of time worrying about minutia, because you have to have a very logical mind, ability to pull things together, and be willing to actually work on the minutia, because when you deal with computer programming, after you write a program, the debugging and getting it to work and work with other components is as important as is the maintenance afterwards. There are a whole variety of sub areas of computer science that are really hot today. So I recommend it.
All right. And Jim, again, thank you for calling. Stephanie in Madison. Hi.
Hi there. Great show. This is really fascinating. I have a question that I don't know if your guest can or would want to answer, but I heard his comment about there really is no real security in on the Internet and our computer systems. So do we still need to do things like shred documents?
I'm sorry?
Do we still need to do things such as, like, shred all of our documents, anything with personal information on it, you know, that sort of thing? How security-minded or security-conscious can we be, and is it just a waste of time to do it?
Well, I mean, if you figure people are going to go dumpster dumping for your stuff, then you – but I – that's something to be concerned about. But I do shred. When I throw out bank statements and tax statements from 10 years ago or whatever, I do shred. So I recommend getting shredders. And
yeah, I have one. I do it.
It's good to do. I mean, the problem with security is that neither the primary operating system, namely Windows, nor the networking architecture, namely IP, TCP/IP, were designed with security in mind, which is really kind of strange, given that it was DARPA, the defense agency.
Yeah.
That paid for developing them. But that's the way it is. And look, when you have organizations like Google, I mean, Google has the smartest people in the world working for it. When they get hacked, like they did from China, you know, yeah, there's an issue, right?
Oh, yeah.
So we simple people now, I guess the only good thing is perhaps, you know, an ordinary person, maybe nobody really cares about your stuff. On the other hand, ordinary people have their social security numbers stolen, and they get there's lots of identity theft. You probably saw that the Internal Revenue Service was having a terrible time because in many parts of the world, the mob has decided that filing for tax refunds using identity theft is more lucrative than drugs.
Yes.
And so there are literally, they have maybe tens or hundreds of thousands of phony tax returns that they get. They send out the refund checks, and then people file their real returns, and whoops, now they have a problem.
Oh, man.
So,
wow.
So security is a difficult problem, and it requires a lot of deep thinking and a lot of expertise to get into it. But but do shred.
Yeah.
I will, and I do, and it's just the whole thing is, it's not only what you think can happen with computers. You just can't assume that everything is really safe. And because it sounds like computers and the internet can just act in real unexpected ways, and you have to just whatever you can do. It's just a general course to be cautious. Look, probably is a good thing.
Look, the internet is an incredible force for good. Around the world, it is doing amazing things in developing countries to bring people up into the 21st century. It has done amazing things for business and for economic development in the United States. But like with all things, there's always the two-edged sword issue. There are the negatives. So we work to support the positives. We build the new applications. We make all these exciting things happen. And then on the other side, we also have to worry about protecting what we've built. So think penicillin, two-edged mm-hmm. sword, right?
Mm-hmm. There you are. And I thank you very much for calling. And just in the last 30 seconds, Tom wonders, do you have any opinion on how long desktop computers will be around for home use? Seems like laptops and tablets and mobile devices are...
I haven't had a desktop computer for about 5 years. I personally like being able to carry my machine when I go to meetings.
Yeah.
I like I like the fact that I can sit in the living room with it on my lap.
Yep.
And what's really neat these days is that you can pretty much get what you want on a laptop. Now, that's not true of everybody. If you are in a media field and you're doing graphics design, you need that 27 or 35-inch screen with very high definition. You can't accept a Mac or a Windows laptop. But if you're an ordinary person doing ordinary applications, maybe even watching movies or whatever, certainly laptops are fine. And that's my personal preference.
Hope you'll come back, Larry. Thank you so much. Larry Land Weber, Emeritus Professor of Computer Science at UW-Madison.